I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, can President Bush pledge future military support to Iraq without an okay from Congress? The president thinks he can. But first, the federal government's ability to spy on Americans without court-issued warrants expires this weekend. The White House insists that letting that law expire puts the nation at risk because terrorists are planning attacks more deadly than 9/11. But critics say warrantless wiretapping violates civil liberties, that the old law is better, and they also object to granting immunity to telephone companies that helped conduct the spying. Well, joining us on the line is Siobhan Gorman. She covers intelligence and national security for the Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, how pitched a battle is this?
Well, it's got a couple different fronts. Certainly, the kind of the core of the Democratic Party is fighting quite hard against the White House and its priority to put more of a legal framework behind its warrantless surveillance efforts, as well as to give legal immunity to phone companies who have helped the government perform some of that surveillance. But there's also kind of a battle within the Democratic Party. It's almost a three-way battle because you have the Democratic leadership, which has been working hard on an alternative proposal, and you also have sort of a more moderate element of the party that has, kind of sided with the White House on this, but then you have a more liberal element of the Democratic Party, which wants individualized warrants for all of this surveillance and doesn't like the direction that this debate is going in at all.
Well, Maryland Congressman Steny Hoyer, a Democrat, says he thinks there's a cover-up. He thinks that by granting immunity to telephone companies, the Bush administration might be trying to keep secret how much warrantless spying was going on before warrantless wiretapping was approved by Congress under pressure last summer. How has the White House responded to that accusation?
Well, the White House has said that the telephone companies were acting in good faith and that the president had decided at that point that their participation was legal and therefore the phone companies should not be punished. Critics say that, companies have a responsibility to their customers as well and that they were falling a little bit short in that responsibility in not sort of pushing back a little bit more on the White House demands as we understand Quest Communications did.
Well, do we know how much warrantless wiretapping was done?
We don't know anything for sure. I mean, all of this information is highly classified, and particularly in terms of the telecommunications company's involvement, access to that information has been highly restricted.
Well, critics of the White House plan to extend the warrantless wiretapping say there's no need for it. There's, first of all, the FISA court, so that there's the ability to go and get a warrant to do any kind of intelligence investigation. And there's also a provision in the eavesdropping law that allows officials to eavesdrop on known terrorist groups for a year after the warrantless law lapses. So what is the concern of the White House?
The concern of the White House is that there will be new threats that emerge after Saturday that they would then be required to obtain a warrant for.
In other words, if a new terrorist group is identified, that new terrorist group is not covered under the warrantless wiretapping law.
Right. And so then you get back into this argument that we had before where the administration says that having to obtain a warrant inhibits their ability to gather intelligence as quickly as possible.
So, Siobhan, is the thinking that Democrats will, as they're threatening, let the warrantless wiretapping law expire on Friday, or will they buckle under political pressure, as their critics say they did over the summer before the August break when they were accused of, being soft on terrorism?
Right now, it sounds like they're taking a tougher stand, and they're trying to make the argument that if the law lapses on, I think it's Saturday, midnight Saturday, that there will be no direct harm that comes to the country, and intelligence agencies will still be fully equipped. It still remains to be seen what additional kind of political pressure the White House will apply, and whether or not that will ultimately change their minds.
Siobhan Gorman covers intelligence and national security for the Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
The Iraqi government announced today that Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, will visit Iraq early next month, reportedly the first ever such trip by an Iranian leader. Iran and Iraq fought a long, brutal war in the 1980s, but relations between the neighbors have improved, and U.S. officials are watching warily. Well, today we want to take a look at the future role of the U.S. in Iraq. President Bush and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki are forging a long-term defense pact, a pledge that U.S. troops would protect Iraq for years to come. The UN mandate allowing the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq runs out at the end of this year, so some legal framework is needed to keep troops there. But critics say the president needs an okay from the Senate to forge a pact. The White House says similar deals have been approved for decades without a congressional stamp of approval. Well, Boston Globe reporter Charlie Savage joins us now. Charlie, this past weekend, President Bush told Fox News Sunday he doesn't envision permanent bases in Iraq. So what is he proposing?
In late November, Bush and Prime Minister Maliki unveiled what they called a joint declaration of principles. This document says that, among other things, the United States will provide security commitments to Iraq to defend Iraq against both foreign attack and attack internally by, quote, outlaw groups. And so what's so interesting about that is that the United States has never entered into an agreement to use our military to go to war to defend another country if it is attacked without that agreement being submitted to Congress, usually as ratification by two-thirds of the Senate.
Well, the White House says the U.S. has hundreds of similar agreements with other countries that never received congressional approval. What are legal scholars saying to you about that?
Well, what they're talking about is there's about 100 status of forces agreements, is what they're called, in which we have an agreement with a country that hosts a military base or allows us to use their airstrip or something like that, like with Uzbekistan right now. And those agreements don't usually get submitted to Congress. But those agreements do not contain these kinds of sweeping guarantees that were outlined in November. They deal with very small issues like leasing arrangements, and if a U.S. soldier is off the base and gets accused of a crime, who will prosecute that soldier? Will the U.S. do it, or will the host country do it? That's a far cry from, we promise we'll go to war if you're attacked.
What are some examples of similar deals that were enacted but did have congressional approval?
Well, all of them. We have NATO. We'll go to war if any NATO member is attacked, as if we were attacked. We have security commitments to the Philippines, to South Korea, to Japan.
What about U.S. military presence in the DMZ in South Korea?
Well, we have a treaty with South Korea negotiated and submitted to the Senate for ratification.
Hasn't there been legislation passed that would block any kind of monies going to Iraq? And presumably these kinds of agreements would require, you know, money from the U.S. to support troops protecting Iraq, for instance. Hasn't there been legislation passed that would block those kinds of monies going to Iraq down the road?
Well, there was in the National Defense Authorization Act, which for 2008, a provision which said that no public money shall be spent for the purpose of establishing permanent military bases in Iraq. But when President Bush signed that law, he put a signing statement on it saying that under his powers as commander-in-chief, that kind of limitation on his power was unconstitutional in his view, and he instructed the executive branch that they would not be bound by that limit if he wanted to ignore it.
You, of course, we should remind listeners, won your Pulitzer Prize for your reporting on the president's extensive use of signing statements, these quiet signatures that would overturn legislation. Obviously, now there's quite a hue and cry about this. Could the White House presumably be making the case that if they don't call it a military base, then they sort of, you know, end run that criticism?
There's a lot here that gets bound up in semantics. And so kind of what you're getting at would be, what does permanent mean? You know, if you have a base with a 50-year lease, is that permanent? No, it's not permanent. It's only there for 50 years. And in the same way, there's some play between a security commitment, which is a binding obligation to go to war, and that was the word used in that agreement back in November. But then there's this lesser category called security assurances, which is sort of fuzzier. It's like, well, we're going to take it seriously and do something, but it's unclear what that is. We've given security assurances, for example, to Israel, but we don't have a treaty with them saying we'll for sure go to war. So maybe there's some room for play in the joints there if the wording is changed a little bit in the final agreement. And I should also say that it's important that as this hue and cry has arisen, some administration officials have tried to back down from what Bush put his signature on back in November. Bush himself this weekend reiterated that he doesn't want permanent bases. The question is, what is permanent? And in addition, in testimony before Congress last week, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that he was told now that perhaps the final agreement with Maliki would not have security, quote, commitments in it, unquote. And the question is, well, what there's something like that's going to be in there, and how are they going to word it? It's clear that they don't want to, whatever happens, they don't want to submit this to Congress. They want this to be a unilateral agreement signed by Bush alone, no doubt for political reasons.
If, in fact, Maliki and Bush do come up with an agreement that has some sort of pledge of security to enable troops to remain on the ground after the UN mandate lapses, and also includes, as we're reading, debt forgiveness, economic and technical aid. You report on perhaps a pledge that would facilitate American investments in Iraq. If the two leaders went ahead and forged that pact without congressional approval, couldn't the next president just renege on that agreement if they disagreed with it?
Well, absolutely, but it's hard to do that for diplomatic reasons, because if the United States says it's going to do something, and then the next president just tears it up because the winds have changed, that president is free to do that. There's no way to sort of enforce such a treaty, but it means that everyone else that we've given similar assurances to is going to say, well, wait, maybe this, you know, isn't worth the paper it's written on. So there's all kinds of very complicated diplomatic reasons why any president would hesitate before reneging on a deal, even though he or she would be free to.
And Charlie, just to be clear, critics of the president, are they critical of his plan to have long-term boots on the ground or his plan to do that without Congress?
It's all of the above. There's no doubt that we're going to have troops in Iraq come January 1st, 2009. President Bush has made that clear. And there's some policy wrangling or worrying, though, about, well, if the next president wants to pull out faster, is this going to make it difficult for that president to shift policy once Bush hands the reins over to whoever wins the election this November? Beyond that, there is some worry about the idea of long-term, not 2009, but, you know, 2029 security commitments, that should we be giving the Iraqis the sense that they never need to get their own security house in order because we'll always be there to fight their battles for them. Both Republicans and Democrats have expressed opposition to that idea because they want Iraqis to take over and not think that there's no consequences if they don't, because we'll be there forever. There is this overriding constitutional concern in general about the idea of establishing a precedent that a president can take unilateral executive action to forge these agreements in a way that would undermine Congress's treaty power, not just in Iraq, but in all future diplomatic scenarios that we don't even know about today.
Charlie Savage, reporter for the Boston Globe and author of Take Over, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and Subversion of American Democracy. Charlie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, do you know what day it is? Well, it's that, but it's also the anniversary of the military surge in Iraq. We'll ask, how well is it going? And of course, it is also Valentine's Day. We're going to hear how a biological anthropologist is bringing her expertise to online matchmaking. That's later, back in 1 minute, here and now. One year ago today, 30,000 American troops headed toward Baghdad in the military offensive known as the Surge. Was it successful? On Monday, we asked retired Army Colonel Andrew Basevich, who said, in essence, no. He said the surge has lowered violence, but ultimately it's failed because the goal was to make room for a political surge, which has not happened. Well, today we get the view of retired Marine captain and former Assistant Secretary of Defense Bing West. He's now a correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He writes about his most recent trip to Iraq in the January issue. Bing West, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And as we said, you were in Iraq in January. You believe the surge has worked. Just tick off the reasons why.
Well, this was my 14th trip, and basically the war is just winding down. There are three different wars. The first war was against the mainstream Sunni resistance who didn't like becoming a minority in a Shiite-dominated state. The Sunnis have now come over to the American side.
This is the so-called awakening, the concerned local citizens.
Correct.
Yes.
But basically most of the people who were fighting us were the tribes, and now the tribes are our new best friend. So that war is over. The second war that's winding down is that once the Sunnis swung against al-Qaeda, they had no place to hide. There's one big battle still to come, and that's up in Mosul. But out in Anbar province to the west, there's no fighting anymore. Al-Qaeda is in real trouble, but they'll always be able to use suicide bombers. And then lastly, there are some of these Shiite death squads, but they know they're being hunted down. So the war is winding down.
You also write that cleric Muqtada al-Sadr ordered his fighters to suspend attacks against the coalition. You write about terrific things that you are watching American troops do, jumpstarting the economy, giving out small loans to people. But here's the question, Bing. All along the way, in your own writing, you also point out the failures of the Maliki government, quoting Iraqis saying, "They're doing nothing for us to get our schools open. We went to a U.S. commander," says one. Another, "If the Americans leave us, it will be a disaster." What about the sense that, you know, yes, the troops are doing extraordinary work in the surge, but the surge is a stalemate, that when the American troops leave, there's no functioning government to take over?
Well, let's distinguish between war and terrible politics. Maliki is a very poor leader. The central government is doing an absolutely horrible job. But I can say that and at the same time say, look, we're over there because it's a war. We can pull our troops out, have won the war, have put al-Qaeda really on the defensive throughout the entire region, and still have an absolute mess in terms of an economy and have a terrible, terrible politics, because that's the definition of what? Half the countries in the world. So I like to distinguish between saying, yes, the politics are terrible, the economy has a, oh my goodness, the poor people have a long way to go, but the war is winding down, and I see no contradiction between them. I think that Maliki's terrible, but that doesn't mean we can't gradually withdraw our troops, and we will have beaten al-Qaeda.
Well, and by the way, in the last few weeks, we've seen terrible bombings that changed some of the numbers on the reduction of violence. Your point that the violence has been reduced is taken. But the point of the surge was to clear the way for the political surge. And you write, for instance, of the Sunnis that have had this so-called awakening, that the U.S. military currently wants them to be employed in the police force or to be put in some kind of a conservation corps. But they are Sunnis. The Shia Maliki government refuses to do that. Those Sunnis, as you write, are not necessarily even loyal to the Americans. They're just fighting al-Qaeda fighters right now. Who's to say there won't be terrible violence if they're not allowed in the government?
Basically, what we've done by arming and organizing the Sunnis in their own neighborhoods, we've put up barriers against Shiites being able to push into those neighborhoods. I mean, that's the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is that the Sunnis are too tough in their neighborhoods for the Shiites to come into. And the Shiites are too tough in their own Shiite neighborhoods for the Sunnis to come into. Now, they're going to have to gradually work out their own politics, but I do not anticipate that as we pull our troops out, that they're going to go back to fighting each other again, because neither side is weak. And at some point, you get worn down in a war, and you sort of say, what do I gain by banging my head against that other neighborhood? And that's where we're getting to.
Well, in fact, Andrew Bacevich says that offering those arms that you mentioned and the payments to the new concerned local citizen groups, which is what they're called, they're being paid by the American forces to patrol the streets. So those are, in effect, bribes to keep the violence down in Iraq.
I have nothing against bribing people. I mean, the entire cost of keeping the Sunni armed forces, which we now have going indefinitely, is well under $100 million a year. And compared to everything else we're spending, this is the greatest cost-effective thing we can possibly do. So if somebody says, hey, we're bribing them, I'll say, hey, if it only costs me $300 a guy to keep peace, I'll pay the $300.
Well, let's talk about the recent news this week that General Petraeus has indicated, and others have said, that after the surge troops are withdrawn this summer, there will be a pause in what was a plan to further reduce the troops in Iraq, a freeze on troop reduction. Now, some are interpreting that as further proof that the surge hasn't worked, because originally the thought was have the surge, bring the calm, and then you can start bringing all the troops home. This pause would seem to indicate that there isn't faith that it will be possible to bring troops home after the surge troops leave.
No. You take anyone in the United States, and make him General Petraeus, and you're going to be prudent. So if you have an option of being prudent, you're going to take your option of being prudent. But the very word pause means just that. I mean, everyone in America knows that we're going to be pulling out. It's just a question of how rapidly we pull out, not if we pull out.
By saying the surge is working, is that equivalent in your mind to saying that the invasion of Iraq was worthwhile?
No. Absolutely no. If we had known how this was going to turn out and tear ourselves apart and that there weren't weapons of mass destruction there, we shouldn't have gone into Iraq. But we're there. So there's no sense in my judgment. I mean, if you don't like the people who are in charge, vote them out, which we're doing. But once you're there, win and then have the arguments.
Former Marine Captain, Assistant Secretary of Defense Bing West. You can read his latest dispatch from Iraq. It's in the Atlantic Magazine. You can go to our website, here-now.org, to see that. Bing West, thanks as always for your opinion.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, quick look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Newsweek's Evan Thomas will be with us with a profile of Republican presidential candidate John McCain. Also, what's up with hip-hop? Sales and mainstream awards are down. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, movies to cuddle up with on a Valentine's Day night. We also have a terrific selection if you hate this day. That's later in the program. After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Idle, you're the oldest. They have to make a match for you before they can make one for me.
And then after her, one for me.
So if Yenta brings someone...
Yenta.
Well, somebody has to arrange the matches.
Well, she might bring someone wonderful.
Someone interesting.
And well off.
And important.
Of course, there are still Yentas, like the one in Fiddler on the Roof, but today, many American women would be horrified at the idea of a matchmaker choosing a husband. Or would they? On this Valentine's Day, we want to take a look at matchmaking online. Dating sites are increasingly moving away from letting users find their own dates to doing the matchmaking for them using mathematical equations. The online dating site Match.com, which uses the old traditional search and date method, hired Dr. Helen Fisher, a biological anthropologist, to develop an algorithm for their new matchmaking site, Chemistry.com. As Dr. Fisher says, people tend to marry people they're familiar with. But she is also trying to put her finger on something else other than social and economic class. Dr. Fisher, you say your work is biological as well as social science. What are you doing?
I looked through the genetic literature, and I came to believe that we've evolved four very broad personality styles associated with dopamine, serotonin, estrogen, and testosterone. So, for example, people who express certain activity in the dopamine system tend to be risk-taking, novelty-seeking, irreverent, optimistic.
Well, so what are some of those questions that get at that?
One of the first ones, I mean, do you like to do things at the spur of the moment? Are you more curious than most people? I mean, there are some people who are going to answer the question because they want to be that. Others who think they are and are not that. But the vast majority of people do answer honestly. And this way, if you answer a whole group of questions that show that you are a risk taker and spontaneous, then I put you sort of in the bin with other explorers. That's what I call these people who express dopamine. If you express a lot of activity in the serotonin system, or what I call a builder, I'll ask the question, are you traditional? Do your friends think you're more traditional than most people? They're calm, they're social, they're popular, they're managerial. And so I ask questions to get at their DNA.
Well, then you ask them to describe which of a series of pictures would be the kind of doodle they'd make in a meeting.
Yes.
How long their fingers are?
Yes, absolutely.
What is that?
Well, the finger one comes right out of a study from Harvard. And actually, we've known this since the 1930s. But if you had more testosterone sweeping over your brain in the womb, not only will there be certain changes in your brain, but also your fourth finger, your ring finger, will be longer than your second or your index finger. And if you had more estrogen in the womb, your fourth and second finger will be the same length, or the pointing finger will be longer. And by the way, this is both men and women. I mean, we know that football players, for example, have a great deal of estrogen as well as testosterone.
Well,
but
First of all, everyone here is looking at their fingers. But secondly, what does it matter if you have more estrogen or testosterone sweeping over you, causing your fingers to be different lengths?
Because it also patterns the brain. And people who had a lot more testosterone in the womb tend to be more tough-minded, more analytical, more logical, better at what we call rule-based systems. Everything from understanding computers to building bridges to being better at chess to being more musical. And so by asking questions about your anatomy, I can begin to understand something about your brain structure, and that bleeds into what your personality is like. And then, of course, I watch what these people, who they choose to go out with, and I begin to see the patterns of who we're drawn to biologically.
Well, we mentioned doodles. What do doodles tell you?
There's a good deal of data on doodles, and the people who express a lot of serotonin like things that are very geometric, very repetitive, very rhythmic, very similar. You know, it's a very repetitive pattern, whereas people who express a lot of dopamine, the explorer, like things that are full of motion, off balance, often very modern. People who are high on estrogen like hearts and pictures of baby faces and animals and flowers. And people who express a lot of testosterone like things that are very geometric, like squares and triangles. And I have data on 40,000 people, and it seems to be true.
Of the dozens of questions on the website, what's one of your favorites?
What kind of people do you hang around with? We all hang around with different kinds of people, but what are most of our friends like? You've got four answers, either adventurers, activists, a social crowd, or intellectuals. And it's remarkable how dramatically the explorer type, the expressive of dopamine, people tend to go with the adventurers. The people who express serotonin tend to say social crowd. The people who are high estrogen tend to go around with activists, and the high testosterone say intellectuals. It's remarkable how these biological types do as one would anticipate they would.
Huh. Of course, you know, there are so many other matchmaking sites, eHarmony.com, PerfectMatch.com. They're all bringing in social scientists and researchers to also...
Yeah, and they're social scientists, and I'm a biological scientist.
Well, and also there seem to be a couple other differences. It's like Coke and Pepsi here in this world, so we don't want to get in the middle of the marketing battles, but at least one of the sites claimed that they couldn't provide services for gays and lesbians because their algorithm is based on heterosexual research. Is your algorithm for everybody?
Absolutely. I think this brain system for romantic love can be triggered in anybody.
Well, I want to ask you about something that's informed your work on love. You use brain scans.
Right.
What does the brain look like when it's in love?
Well, there's activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. And this brain region actually makes dopamine and sends dopamine to many brain regions. And dopamine is a natural stimulant. As a matter of fact, exactly the same brain region becomes active when you feel the rush of cocaine. So the brain becomes sort of electrified. I mean, you can feel that. It's hard to eat. It's hard to sleep. You can't stop thinking about this person. You crave emotional union with the person. You become sexually possessive of them. But most important, you can't stop thinking about them. It's an obsession, romantic love. In fact, it's an addiction. A wonderful addiction when it's going well, and a perfectly horrible one when it's going poorly. But the brain really responds very dramatically when you're in love.
Well, that thing you're talking about, that chemical reaction, like just about everyone, I know people who have met and married on these websites, but it just feels like how can you possibly replace the thing that happens when you see someone and you fall in love, the whatever it is, the thing that happens in the back of your brain? What would you say to those who just don't understand how you can do that online without seeing someone?
I think that you do see the person online. I mean, you see their picture and many pictures of them sometimes. You get their writing, and on chemistry.com you write back and forth. You get all kinds of understanding of what their interests are, what their goals are.
In fact, you said that internet dating is actually more natural to the human brain than meeting someone in a bar.
When you walk into a bar, you don't have a clue of who this person is, what their background is, what their intentions are, anything at all about them. I'm an anthropologist for millions of years on the grasslands of Africa. You might not know that cute boy on the other side of the waterhole, but you know what he does for a living. Your mother probably knows his aunt. You know about his background. You know about his religious beliefs. You know a lot about him in all of these dating sites. I mean, by the time somebody goes on them, you know something about their intentions. If it's at one of the dating sites, is where we match you. You get to know quite a bit about the person before you ever go out with them. But you know what's really important, Robin, is that the reason these dating sites are useful today is that we're marrying later. We're not meeting our husbands and wives in high school and in college. And by the time we're really looking to settle down, those opportunities have gone by. And now we're looking for somebody seriously. We don't want to do it in the office. We've met everybody in our social set. And I think what online dating is just a continuation of the old, old human process of finding the right person. It's just the newest mechanism.
Dr. Helen Fisher, a biological anthropologist, a leading researcher on the science of love, and now hired to develop algorithms for the new matchmaking site, chemistry.com. Dr. Fisher, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
And you are listening to Here and Now. And let's turn now to matchmaker Catherine Lord, an online romance coach. Catherine first tried online dating herself in 1998 and hated it. Then she heard a report on NPR and decided to try it again. A scientist named Drew heard the same report and also logged on. A flurry of emails later, the two met and are now married, joining millions finding love online. eHarmony.com claims it was responsible for 2% of marriages in the U.S. last year. But Catherine, why did you first hate online dating?
It was brand new then. There was nothing out there as far as help is concerned. It felt like the old-fashioned newspaper personal, which seemed kind of tacky and exposed.
You've pointed out that there was a sort of a turning point for online dating, and it was 9/11.
Well, as we all remember, the country went into pretty much a state of shock for several months, and people became more concerned about the shortness, the brevity of life, that anything could happen at any time, and they really started yearning for connection. And suddenly what had been under the radar, not quite reputable, came right into the mainstream. People flocked to the dating sites after that. It suddenly became okay.
So now what are you doing now to help other people?
I've been working for the last 6 years to develop an online dating site where people can find help to negotiate internet dating, to make the experience less frightening, less terrifying than it was for me.
What are they asking you? What are the things that you think they need to know?
Well, we talk about what dating site to use, which ones are best for them. Also, people almost always need help getting their online presentation ready, their profile, essay, and their photos. We'll talk about safety rules, and they often just need a lot of hand-holding. They're scared.
How do you remain safe?
Well, you don't want to give anyone your home address or your home phone number. In fact, there are sites that help you with that anonymity. Some of the dating sites, you can make anonymous phone calls through the site. And I think one of the chief advantages of online dating is that you can get to know someone and ask hard questions before you actually meet.
How can you be sure? I mean, do you ever recommend that they actually take those resumes and run them through a police blotter?
Some people do, for sure. You Google a person. But, of course, when it comes to first meetings, you always meet in a public place. It's a good idea to make it a middle-of-the-day coffee date. You take your own phone, you take your own money, and you take your own transportation. Another thing to watch out for is this person keeping you fairly isolated so they never introduce you to anyone?
Like their wife.
Like their wife.
Right. Well, as you said, you advise people about sites. There are literally hundreds. There's, of course, Match.com and eHarmony and Perfect Match, but there are sites for vegetarians, dog owners, music lovers, cyclists, Christian singles, African Americans, Latinos. How do you pick a site?
Well, most of my clients are female and over 40. Internet dating tends to be a numbers game, so you want to look for a site that's well-established and large. The sites like eHarmony, which does matching, are very comfortable for women because the site does the matching for you. And the gender ratios are really quite skewed. eHarmony has been careful about releasing their statistics, but I did find one that said 68% of their people are female.
So they have better chances at a site that isn't as skewed
to women.
And men, you say in general, men don't like the passive sites where you just fill out questionnaires and they do all the work. Men want to see the pictures and pick someone out. And you agree with them.
I like to know everything that's available. I'm an old Sears Roebuck catalog fan. I wanted to look at everything before I made my choice. And I don't want the site withholding people from me. They don't show you the ones that they don't think will match you. Well, maybe I have odd tastes, right?
I just love the idea of comparing, your future husband to, a drill bit in a Sears Roebuck catalog. But there you go. Have you had any marriages?
One this summer. Interestingly, this is a woman who, the first guy she met when I was working with her, she met on eHarmony, and that guy scammed her. He took her for a bunch of money, but she got right back on, and now she's met a guy that is really sterling.
And what would you say to someone who would say, this is crazy, you know, why are you such a big advocate of online dating?
Well, I would turn that around, Robin, and I'd say, why not? The most recent thing I heard was that meeting someone online is second only to meeting someone through friends and family as the preferred way to meet now. You know, it's foolish not to now. It just makes sense in our day and age that, you know, people are more used to using the computer to order a pizza or, you know, buy an engagement ring. Why not use it to help find love, too? It's just another tool, like a telephone, or I think of it more like a telephone directory. Now, there are some people who still have reservations and question it and say they would never do it, but those folks are getting less and less.
Catherine Lord, former psychotherapist, now an online romance coach. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match.
And by the way, Catherine's site is findasweetheart.com. We'll link you at here-now.org. Back in a minute, here and now.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, look through your book.
Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm tired. Let's stay in and watch a movie. Okay with you? Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr is here with our annual suggestions for movies to curl up with on Valentine's Day night. Ty, welcome as always.
Thanks, Robin. Nice to be here.
And as we say every year, not that kind of movie. You brought with what you call, what, classics?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They're romantic movies that stand the test of time.
Well, let's start with the first. Actually, there are two. Double feature, the 1995 film Before Sunrise, its sequel, the 2004 film Before Sunset, both starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy and directed by Richard Linklater. In the first, Before Sunrise, they play a young couple who just meet by chance on a train. He comes up with a plan. Let's listen.
I want to keep talking to you. You know, I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on. It'll be fun.
And then he kills her. No?
No. Sorry.
How nice.
But
he
doesn't even sleep with her. They literally spend the night walking around talking. It's one of the great, glorious, I'm young and I'm in love and I'm crazy and I'll stay up all night with you and we'll talk about all the incredibly important things in life because we're young and we're in love. It's a wonderful movie for that precise moment in time.
How wonderful. Before Sunrise with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. But then you also love the sequel, the 2004 film Before Sunset. The characters, Jesse and Celine, what's happened to them 9 years later?
Well, Jesse, the Ethan Hawke character, who's an American, has gone back. He's become a writer. He's written a novel about that night in Vienna. And he's come back to Paris to give a reading. And Celine, who lives in Paris, shows up at the book reading, as he sort of hoped she would. They haven't seen each other or spoken in 9 years. And they spend another lovely day, more measured, less insanely passionate, but fanning the embers of romance back into something like maybe a fire.
Well, we have a scene. This is where they meet again in the bookstore, as you said, for the first time in 9 years. He asks her about the book.
Did you have a chance to read it?
Yes, I was really, really surprised, as you can imagine. I mean, I had to read it twice, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Comme ci, comme ça?
No, I liked it.
Yeah?
It's very romantic. I usually don't like that, but it's really well written. It's really
no,
well written.
Right,
no, I really, congratulations.
You.
Both movies are about the way we talk when we're trying to talk ourselves into love, into attracting somebody else. But it's glorious dialogue, improvised in large part by the actors. They take credit for the screenplay along with Richard Linklater. And if Before Sunrise is a movie for young lovers, Before Sunset is a movie for people who've been around the block.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, you've got some films that have been around the block but have withstood the test of time. And you are a big fan of old black and white films, and you've written a book about old films to watch with young kids. But today you've brought some films to watch with someone you love. Let's start with 1945's I Know Where I'm Going. It stars Wendy Hiller as a headstrong young woman who travels to a Scottish island to marry a wealthy man. But in this scene, she meets a handsome young naval officer played by Roger Livesey. Let's listen.
Bad luck. No crossing today.
But isn't that the boat from Killoran?
No.
And if she was, it is not today she'd be getting back, my lady.
That's the ferry boat. Pity you didn't keep Ian's car. That's why I was shouting.
But we didn't understand. Why should I keep it anyway?
To go back to Tobermory and spend the night in a comfortable bed.
But I intend to spend the night on Killoran.
Oh.
But maybe something else is going to happen.
Well, there's that pesky fog that just keeps rolling in as if God himself were sort of pushing it along to keep her from going to the island. This is one of those movies like Local Hero about a person who shows up from the city, who knows where they're going and knows exactly what they want out of life, and comes to a little magical place on the fringes of Scotland and is seduced by the magic of the place, by the light, by the locals, and of course by some special somebody there who's absolutely not what she's looking for in life. But, you know, sometimes you don't make that choice.
Oh, it just sounds great. That's I Know Where I'm Going. We'll have the list for you, by the way, at our website, here-now.org. Now on to the 1940 film The Shop Around the Corner, starring Jimmy Stewart, Margaret Sullivan, better known to some perhaps through the remake, starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, called You've Got Mail. You prefer the original. Why?
Oh, I think anybody who sees the original has to prefer the original because, well, for one thing, it's not about email. It's about letter writing, which is a lost art and a highly romantic art. For the other thing, it stars James Stewart with really the woman who was probably his best on-screen match, Margaret Sullivan. They were in a number of films together, and they really came together quite well in a way, you know, like Tracy had Hepburn. James Stewart had Margaret Sullivan. They really have sort of a privileged thing going on screen. And this is about two shop workers who hate each other, but they're secretly writing anonymous pen pal letters to each other through a service, much the way we would pick somebody up online today.
My heart was trembling as I walked into the post office, and there you were lying in box 237. I took you out of your envelope and read you right there.
And they fall in love in their letters while driving each other crazy in life. And it is about how those two spheres come together, how sometimes the person who drives you the most crazy is actually the person you love the most.
The Shop Around the Corner with Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, again, just sounds terrific. Well, we want to move up again to 1990. Now, people might remember the 1990 film Ghost with Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore, a man who dies but can't bear to be separated from his wife even in death. You say that same year there was another film on the same topic that you'd rather talk about, Truly, Madly, Deeply, with Alan Rickman and Juliette Stevenson. Tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, it really, in a way, it's the thinking person's ghost. It's a British film. It stars Alan Rickman, who, you know, everybody knows as villains from the Die Hard movies and as Snape in Harry Potter, but has, in his serious dramatic roles, he's just one of the most romantic people walking on the earth. And Juliette Stevenson is one of the great actresses of England. And here in 1990, they're young. They're playing a couple in love. He is unfortunately dead. They were married. They were happy. He dies in a stupid accident. And she is so bereft that he's got to come back. He has to come back and tend to her.
Tell me about the first night we spent together.
Why? Seriously? You want me to?
What did we do?
We talked.
What else?
Well, talking was the major component. You played that piano. Then I played. Then we both played something. Duet. Something. Can't remember. And then you danced for about 3 hours until I fell asleep. But you were fantastic. And then we had some cornflakes. And when we kissed, which was at about 11 o'clock the following morning, we were trembling so much we couldn't take off our clothes.
Oh, my. And, you know,
I'm telling you, it works.
Yeah, and in particular, you know, I'm thinking if you have had a loss, this might be something to really go to that place. Well, that's Truly, Madly, Deeply. But what if, you know, you're out there and you don't care about Valentine's Day? You are determined to just curl up by yourself. Do you have a movie for someone like that, someone who hates Valentine's Day?
Oh, yeah. I would probably recommend Pandora's Box, the Louise Brooks silent classic about a completely amoral woman wreaking vengeance on men while having the time of her life. Yeah, it's silent. It's more modern than a lot of movies made today.
It was re-released in 2006 in a box set with 4 different film scores?
Yes, exactly. Orchestral, cabaret. P. piano, and then a more modern orchestral score.
We've been talking to Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr about Valentine's Day films. For a complete list of his picks, go to our website, here-now.org. And remember, if you are spending Valentine's Day with the kids, there's also Ty's book, The Best Old Movies for Families, A Guide to Watching Together. Ty, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.